A podcast of the cinema.
Brought to you. You know what I was thinking?
Oh, no.
I was thinking that, you know, we've been doing the brought to you by Exile and Guyville, the audiobook.
Yes.
But, you know what? If people join the club, if they join Club Linoleum Knife.
Right.
And they subscribe on Patreon, then they automatically get...
Well, at certain levels.
The audiobook, if they subscribe to a certain level. Obviously, they can buy the audiobook.
A la carte.
A la carte, you know, via the Tumblr link, which we put up on.
ExileandGuyvilleBook.tumblr.com?
Yeah, but the... but it's... I think it's a better deal...
Overall...
to join the club, be a subscriber on Patreon.
Sure.
So I think that we should change the brought to you by, in the absence of actual advertisers.
Sponsors, yeah. Yes.
We should say brought to you by
members like you.
Yes. Members like you ought to be.
Yes.
Now, I just learned this morning that our 215th subscriber just signed on. So, Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema hosted by me, Dave White, and also by whoever sitting right here is, okay, Alonzo Duralde.
The real star.
It is brought to you by members like you should be.
Yes.
Of Club Linoleum Knife.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. All right, enough.
Here's what's up.
Oh, God.
I'm gonna explain it a little bit.
This is the top of the show.
People this is the top of the show.
In
no, 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 they're not. It's $4 a month. We'll tell you more details at the end of the show.
Fine.
But $4. $4. We have a guest. Tell about the guest.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. Well, we're thrilled. A dear friend of ours who we've somehow never had on, but is here today. Please welcome from formerly of Variety and now at the Los Angeles Times. Justin Chang is here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
No, we're delighted.
About time.
Indeed. You got his mic all
yes, it's
niced
great.
Up. Nice.
I know. We are long overdue. And really, we felt particularly shamed after you got such a loving tribute from Ryan Coogler.
Oh, good God.
At the LA Film Critics Dinner. I could sense you dying inside because I know you don't like that level of public adulation.
I wish that on everyone once or twice in their life where you are just... in a room full of people you love, know, respect, and out of nowhere, completely, what the hell, unprompted, undeserved, just completely like someone
What's
starts singing your praises.
To
I
me?
Just, yeah. What, whoever that person is, whatever the reason, everyone should have that in their life. And my eternal thanks to Mr. Coogler.
I was there that night, and it was pretty delightful to watch him, like, sing about you, basically.
Yeah, because, you know, we had seen Ava DuVernay in that same position, and she worked the room.
She worked the room.
She, you know, former publicist that she is, before becoming a filmmaker, she was totally like, and you get some praise, and you get some praise, and you get some praise, but Coogler was just love-infesting you. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, and it's funny because we talked, I think, I ran into him at the Star Wars premiere of all things a few weeks before the LAFCA dinner. And he is just like this ball of energy and joy. And he'd remembered, you know, it was funny because when he told that story, because I mean, I have to be completely honest, I had completely forgotten about the Cannes thing where he was a young, like an intern, I think, at Variety, or he was kind of tagging along with the Variety team in Cannes. Right. And I think we'd met there very briefly. And so... it was very, very special, and I, you know, and very cool to see a filmmaker I really respect, and who's making really good movies.
Yeah.
you know, encountering the success and still, you know, bringing it back and really praising critics. I mean, I think all of us can kind of relate to that. Just doesn't happen.
True.
Nearly as much as it should be to have some, you know, and I think it really shows someone who is, you know, hasn't lost touch with, you know, I mean, he's still very young in his career, you know, and is, yeah, that was, it was a lovely moment.
No, that's one of the interesting things about living in Los Angeles is that people, you know, I remember when I lived here in the early 90s, they would always talk about how when Stone Temple Pilots were having their moment, Scott Weiland.
They did what?
When Stone Temple Pilots were having their moment as a band, you know.
You mean the 90s when you first lived here?
Yes, before you and I moved here, in the early 90s. Scott Weiland had been a busboy at this restaurant that was very popular among sort of like, you know, artsy types that I knew, and so they just always thought it was hilarious that he was now like a rock star, you know. And Justin Simien, you know, used to be our Paramount publicist, you know, and one of the few who would return our phone calls, and now he's a big deal filmmaker. It's, you know, it's cool to see folks, you know, work their way up the ladder that way.
I mean, remember that, you know, Michael Shannon, who is such an established guy by now, but who was so humbled by our giving him Best Supporting Actor for 99 Homes, saying how, you know, he used to, he just never thought we'd be here, and he had just enormous respect for critics bothering to, like, watch upwards of 200 movies a year, and it was, it's really nice when you find people who have not, you know, become jaded.
Sure.
This is just whatever, another one of these things.
Like when I always love when Marcia Gay Harden won an Oscar and thanked all the people that she was on waitress shifts with who would cover for her so she could go on auditions. Yeah. They're like, all right, you're a dude. That's pretty great. So you mentioned Cannes, and one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is you just got back from the Cannes Film Festival where you've covered it for years for Variety, and this was your first time doing it for LA Times, and doing some very spot-on coverage as always, not just reviewing the films, but talking about the bigger story. I think you were one of the more articulate people who kind of talked about, let's jump right into this, the disconnect between the jury and film critics, and obviously, I think those two bodies always kind of operate on different planes, especially because the jury is pretty much all actors and filmmakers and production people, right?
All, you know, and it's funny because it kind of kicked off this really interesting discussion. I mean, I was definitely, I think mine was one of the early and therefore one of the angrier pieces in response because I really was and I was not alone. I think a lot of us who were watching the awards that night were really appalled by some of the decisions. And it was kind of an overall thing. You know, the festival jury gives out about 6 or 7 awards every year.
Right.
And usually there's some good ones in there. And there were some good ones. But I think...
What got the big awards? I'm blanking now.
Ken Loach for this film, I, Daniel Blake.
Yes.
Which, you know, I mean, I don't think Ken Loach deserved his first Palm. So I was a little bit, you know... And look, he's a great filmmaker. I love Kes, love Sweet 16, love, you know... many, many Ken Loach films that I love. But I, you know, he's a 2-time Palm winner now. For this film, which a lot of people really liked, you know, this was not a critically unacclaimed film, I would say, even though I didn't particularly warm to it. But what really appalled everyone was the Xavier Dolan film,
right.
It's Only the End of the World, which is kind of how a lot of us felt when he won the Grand Prix, which was basically the second place.
That's like second place. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the lowest, one of the worst. I mean, I think if Sean Penn's terrible movie, The Last Face, about Javier Bardem and Charlize Theron as, you know, international aid workers falling in love with Africa, third world suffering as their wallpaper.
I cannot wait.
It's a pretty entertaining movie. I mean, that screening, which was like toward the end of the festival, was one of the more cathartic. People were laughing it off the screen 30 seconds in. I kid you not.
I haven't laughed out loud at a Charlize Theron movie since Sweet November.
Oh, no. What about the one where Kim Basinger can't vacuum?
Oh, yeah, that was good, too. What was it called?
The Burning Plane
the
or burning, something?
Oh, The Burning Plane. The Arriaga.
Whatever.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was special. I mean, it's funny because it was overall, this is why also I think the awards were disappointing for me and for a lot of other critics, because it was quite a strong festival.
Right.
And there were many, many good to great films, and it's funny, sometimes you see something like that Sean Penn movie at the very end and you're kind of relieved. It's like after all this quality, it's kind of great to sort of like have something that represents the complete opposite of all that.
Well, I don't need to rejigger my rankings, certainly.
No, exactly. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing you mentioned about the disconnect between jurors and critics. And it's funny because they used to have a critic serve on the jury up until a Cannes historian would know this better than I do, but Pauline Kael famously served on the jury once. And
oh, no kidding.
And the the Berlin Film Festival, I believe, still has a critic. Nick James of Sight and Sound was on there just this past year, I believe. And I think that's a good thing, because when I was writing about it, I addressed very much what Joel Cohen said as president last year. This is not a jury of film critics, and I think that's a good thing. Yes, of course, we as critics will always think that our opinions are superior and better informed. This is what we do. We do watch a lot more movies, but we also have to respect that, actors, directors. I mean, it's the same thing with the Academy Awards. Why are we always lamenting the choices that people make? Well, it's because, we watch a lot more movies than they do.
That's true.
The average person does. And so I understand, even if I don't agree. But that said, I feel like I've been covering Cannes for about 11 years now, and I've always felt a little spoiled by the fact that I think they've had an exemplary run of top prize winners in the past, like things that films that I really love, like Amour. Mm-hmm. I was a fan of Blue is the Warmest Color. I loved Uncle Boonmi. I loved The Tree of Life. The Class. I know not many people don't. That's kind of an under-heralded movie, I think, but I feel like they've always, The Class, picked by jury president Sean Penn, nonetheless, no one else. But so that's great. And so it was really disappointing to me that they shut out completely, and we can get into some of the really great movies that were there, which, like Tony Erdmann and Patterson, the new Jim Jarmusch movie. And I feel like they really overlooked, we've heard so much this year and in last year too about, needing more women in front of the camera and behind the camera. The Cannes Film Festival has always been an interesting gauge of that, and they've come under a lot of criticism for not having enough female directors in competition, for example. And this year, they had three. That's still not great, but it's an improvement.
Yeah, well, at least a plateau. Last year was three also.
Was it three last year? Yeah. So, and I would say, and this is, sadly, this is not always the case, but two of the three films I really, really liked and thought were among the top, among the cream of the crop, kind of, and Tony Erdmann, directed by the German director Marinade, was I think either the best or the second best film that I saw.
I've been hearing that a lot. Yeah,
that's what people say.
Can't wait for you guys to see it. Sony Classics bought it. Mm-hmm. They're probably going to give it a big foreign language film awards push. It's just really, on paper, it sounds like this kind of goofy father daughter. She's too serious, he's too much of a clown, and they kind of, and it's, and it's also close to 3 hours, which is kind of one of the things people have been saying about it.
For a German comedy? Wow.
I mean, that in itself, which, if you don't know, I'm not a German cinema expert, it almost seems like a contradiction in terms. But I think that was what was so disarming about it, too. And I really liked Marinade's previous film, Everyone Else, which, not a lot of people saw, but which is really worth checking out. And so this one, though, that was not a comedy. At least not in the, it was in some ways a very dark comedy, but this one is really, really funny and sad. And there are one or two moments in here where it just kind of, the audience just kind of erupted in applause, something you always, it's nice when that happens in Cannes.
Well, have you ever been on one of the juries for Film Independent? For the Spirit Awards or anything?
Yes. I was on a Spirit Awards committee, and I've been on like the Gotham nominating, if that's kind of what,
I don't know how,
or Gotham, festival juries.
How Gotham does it, but in the case of Spirit Awards, it's definitely always a thing where there's at least one critic in there, and there's at least one festival programmer, and then there are also filmmakers. And I think you're right. It's all of one definitely stirs you in a certain direction, but I think having that mix in there really prompts a discussion, and each side kind of maybe looks at things in a way they wouldn't have otherwise.
I think it's absolutely. I think it's good to have just at least one voice in there to kind of counterbalance that. And maybe that. And who's to say that critic is smarter than the? I think, and it's funny. The reason why I was a little disappointed because I. Like you guys, I admire George Miller so very much, and that has not changed, by the way.
Yeah,
I have enormous respect for him as a director, and it's like you don't want to pin. He was the president, but you don't know what the dynamics are. I don't want to guess at that.
I blame everything on Kirsten Dunst.
I don't know. It's kind of funny because I don't know. No. It's like, no, it's, and I love Kirsten Dunst too, personally, yeah. But I mean, it's like, I overheard something that someone who may have been her, may have been someone else in the jury who was complaining particularly about how long these movies are and how hard it is to watch 20 movies in 2 weeks. And we're all the critics are just sort of, you know, the smallest violin in the world playing for you. But this is a good reminder, though, that, yeah, that is not typical behavior for most people.
For laymen, yeah.
For lay people, absolutely. And, you know, Donald Sutherland was on the jury, and he was kind of, I believe, backslapping Xavier Dolan. So people were wondering, was there some kind of Canadian boosterism kind of going on? I don't know. Part of me is a little unseemly to pick this part. I mean, come on, it's just a jury. But I think that because it's the Cannes Film Festival,
of course,
the most these are very prestigious awards that can, you know, change the fortunes of these films. So it's
the one thing I will say, and just on their benefit, is that I've kind of been on the other side of that this year. Sure. I was on the South by Southwest jury, and it was all critics. It was three of us, and boy, did other critics not like our choice.
I liked your choice.
Yeah, thank you.
I liked the Arbalest.
We gave it to the Arbalest, and a lot of critics were like, "What the?" You know, and a lot of like, "Oh, well, I guess, you know, contrarian Richard Brody," and then he just cowed the other director. Yeah, thanks. I just let myself be rolled over by Richard Brody.
He alpha'd you.
Yeah, no. It was the movie
because that's so easy to do.
You all liked, yeah.
Yeah, but again, but also with the jury, it's like you have to come to an agreement, and it's not necessarily going to reflect each person's druthers, but I think ultimately everybody stands behind the choices, you know.
I've spent 20 years trying to boss you around. It barely works.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. You know.
And that's the thing, because usually, you know, there have been, you know, like I said, there's usually at least one good choice in there. And there were some good ones. Like, I think, you know, the director prize, for example, was split between Christian Mungiu, who I'm sure a lot of listeners know from 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, and Beyond the Hills. His new movie, Graduation, I think is quite good indeed. Really, really something I'm looking forward to people discovering. And Olivier Assayas for his new film, Personal Shopper, with Kristen Stewart as a medium in a ghost story, which is
I can't wait.
Awesome.
I know. It's I'm really, excited for that one.
I saw, that was the one movie I saw twice in Canada.
I love him.
Were you at the booing screening?
I was at the booing screening, and again, you know, looking at my colleagues, like, what are people booing about? I mean, it's like, you know, generally I'm opposed to booing in film festivals. I think, you know, something
I think it's undignified. I know it's a thing that they do at Cannes, and it's a tradition, and there's that sort of wildness going on.
I got hissed at San Francisco one at Frameline.
You did.
Showing a clip from Cruising. When I was doing my first book. So, yeah, that's a buoy festival. I told the story recently about seeing a bigger splash in Venice.
Oh, yes, that's right.
The Italians, the Italians don't like
that one
what's
guy,
his face?
Right.
Guadagnino, yeah.
They don't like Guadagnino, and I think they were protesting something very locally specific.
There was
about
the
film.
Guy who plays the cop at the end of the movie was like a TV comedian or something, and that was just that took him out of it or something.
I mean, you never know the reasons people are doing it. Something it is something that seems very trivial like that. Would I object?
Or it's the brown bunny,
exactly. But you know, which is, you know, I'm kind of a brown bunny defender. It's like, I mean, people were affronted by that being in this prestigious competition, but the thing that I really generally dislike about booing at film festivals is that I always think it's kind of a reflection of, not that this is the worst movie or that I truly hate this movie, but this movie tried to do something different.
How dare you?
Seriously. Right, yeah. And it's like the Assayas movie, for example, Personal Shopper, is weird. It's genre. It's all over the place. It's unresolved. It's ambiguous. Yeah. And these things, which I think are great things to celebrate in a movie, you know, get kind of like, you know, this movie is like misbehaving. This movie's out of line or something. And which I think is a really stupid attitude to have at a festival like Cannes, where you should be open to that kind of thing. So
let's talk about Dolan a little, because he's every one of his features, except one, I think, has screened not just at Cannes, but in competition. Is that right?
Well,
everything with Tom at the Farm, I thought?
Tom at the Farm was in competition at Venice, and I can't remember if that was boot or not. I'm not sure. But actually, in Cannes, Mommy was his first one in competition, but then he'd had, like I Killed My Mother was in Critics Week, I believe.
Okay, so they've all screened Lawrence anyways. Somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they've all been in the official. But yeah, he's definitely been
in
that prestigious spotlight.
What am I missing? I've
are you not a fan?
I've seen like three of his films, so I'm not fully, you know, able to sort of say yes or no. But what I've seen so far, I'm not completely wowed. And this guy is clearly, I mean, he's not necessarily the toast of international cinema, but boy, they love him in Cannes.
Yeah, and it's weird to me because I kind of came out swinging pretty hard at this latest movie, which I think I'm curious to see what you think of it, but it's, even people, I've considered myself a fan at points, not a diehard fan, not someone who thinks he should have won the Palme d'Or three times by now, which some of his fans do. I remember last, with Mommy, which I was, okay on, I didn't have really strong feelings one way or the other.
That was the year he shared an award with Godard.
Godard, right? And it's like, come on, that's like, you can take that as a compliment, buddy. Yeah. I mean, but he took, his fans were like so, indignant on his behalf. Like, how dare they give him third place, and how dare they make him share it with Godard? Yeah. And so here he wins second place for this film, which is much, much, much worse than Mommy. I mean, he's chosen to basically shoot it in this. It's basically the most kind of derivative, uninteresting, unrevealing, dysfunctional family, hysterical movie shot extreme close up. Like every scene, I felt like I was watching like a pore cleansing skin commercial or something. And just, and it's an interesting, for about 5 minutes, and it's an interesting kind of stylistic choice. I've never seen Marion Cotillard this bad. I've never seen Natalie Bai this bad. He's got Vincent Cassel. He's got some of the great Gaspar Ulliel. He's got this great cast.
Yeah.
The only one I think who kind of survives is Léa Seydoux, but everyone is bad in it. Oof. It's one of the shorter movies that was at Cannes, and it felt like one of the longer ones. It really was excruciating. So that said, I mean, hated the movie. Definitely not one of his haters in general. And he, and you try not to take the filmmaker's character or their comments into account, but he makes it very difficult to do that, I think.
Well, it's almost inescapable. There's this notion of it's not just that the movies have to exist on their own. It's the, check me out, I'm the 26-year-old enfant
wunderkind,
terrible,
enfant terrible, exactly. Yeah.
That a little of that goes a long way for me.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And apparently the reviews to this were so hostile, and because he is the kind of filmmaker who reads every one of his reviews and will sometimes respond via social media, I think he really took issue with some of my friend Jessica Kiang, who reviewed it for the playlist and was pretty unsparing, rightly so, and he basically accused her in an article about, of saying like, this is gossip, this is not journalism, these are like unwarranted personal attacks. And it's like, well, you kind of open yourself up to that a little bit. And, and he apparently was saying that I can't stand it anymore. He threatened to quit filmmaking altogether, which I don't want him to do. I say it again, I think I will be interested in seeing what he always does next, because he's made some films I like. I like Tom at the Farm. I like, I even like Heartbeats, which is this one that I think it was his second or third
second,
film.
I think.
Second,
yeah.
And kind of a trifle, but I thought a really charming one that shows that he has a lot of flair and talent. So I need
to do some catching up, but the ones I've seen have not set me on fire so far.
I am a little surprised by just the extent of the adulation, and I think it reveals less about his talent than just about the kind of sensibility that he has, which is very emotional. It's pretty narcissistic. It's very emotionally self-bearing, and there can be bravery in that. But
so he's the perfect filmmaker for the age of Facebook.
I think so. Pretty much.
Just a thought. All right, so tell us about what you liked, besides Tony Erdmann.
Tony Erdmann's great. Loved the Jim Jarmusch movie, Patterson, which is, you kind of have to love this movie just from hearing what I think was probably the conceit that it started out from, because Adam Driver plays a bus driver. The whole movie, and who's also a poet. The movie
falls in love with Minnie Driver, no.
That would have been...
Adam Driver, and you see him driving all over the movie.
Yeah. The movie is structured like that. It's like there's all these little jokes and doublings and repetitions and wordplay, which, is kind of my thing.
Oh,
I love,
sure.
Yeah. I'm sort of a biased fan of the film in that respect, but he's also a poet.
Say it like the internet says it. You are biased.
You are biased.
Yeah.
You are a bi-
You are biased. Yes. That's
you're just
how dare you? Yeah.
The kids don't understand how that word functions.
And no. So
the internet usage of it has become you're biased.
Like, for a while, Devin Faraci's name on Twitter was I am biased.
I am biased. Yeah. It reminds me of this, you know, total digression. This this bouncer at our high school who was like, not bouncer, he was like our, used to look out for, make sure you weren't leaving campus early, make sure you weren't cutting class. And he would, once he stopped me and someone, or somebody else, and he would say like, you know, that's just blatant wrong what you're doing. It's just blatant wrong. Anyways, I don't know why I just thought of that.
I guess if wrong is a noun.
maybe it works. Maybe noun modifiers. But no, so Patterson is really, it's a film about poetry. It's a film that he is a poet.
Uh-huh.
He writes poems in his spare time, taking inspiration from kind of the effluvia of his everyday kind of reality. And it's just really, it's this lovely, even keel. There's no, you know, it's Jim Jarmusch. There's no drama whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It's, and it just gets you on this incredibly zen wavelength that was just like, it was like drinking a really cool, clear glass of water, that movie. And it was just, everyone was just completely charmed by it. It's really funny, too.
Oh, cool.
It's got a great dog in it. An nice. English bulldog, you know, always
did
a good thing.
Did it get picked up?
It it is an Amazon Studios release. Okay. It's one of one of the five, and I think by the end of the festival, six or more.
Yeah, films I heard they were really all over this festival.
Amazon was the toast of Cannes in a lot of ways. They had the opening night film, Woody Allen's Café Society.
Right.
They had Patterson. They had Park Chan-wook's very entertaining new film, The Handmaiden.
Which is
not
based
to be confused
on,
with The Housemaid,
right? Which we were talking about. Which is based on Fingersmith, right?
Based on Fingersmith, yeah. Translated to 1930s Korea under Japanese occupation. And I'm not a huge fan of Park Chan-wook. I'm not, you know, Old Boy, Thirst, and those things like that. I can kind of take or leave. So this was a really pleasant surprise.
Oh,
it's
nice.
Really, really entertaining.
You know Fingersmith, right?
No.
That's Sarah Waters, like it's Victorian England, yeah. Sort of lesbian pickpockets. There was a British TV miniseries of it that was really popular. And
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
And another one that I was a fan of, and surprisingly a lot of people were, was L, the new Paul Verhoeven movie.
I can't wait.
It's worth waiting for. I mean, this was the very last film to screen, and it really ended things, I think, on a strong note. Isabelle Huppert, who, you know, it's no surprise to hear she's given another amazing, face-meltingly great performance.
And you know, Verhoeven does not get the credit he deserves for directing women.
I think of him in a lot of ways, you know, and, you know, case by case, film by film, but sort of the way Brian De Palma, the rap he's gotten sometimes about, you know, people accusing him of being misogynist in the past, but then you realize, oh, actually, especially in retrospect, it's like, he's doing something a little more complex than that.
Right? Absolutely.
You know, and that's really true here. I mean, this is a movie, I mean, it kind of got this sort of unfair description around Cannes is like the rape, quote unquote, rape comedy.
Oh my.
It's like two words you just don't usually put together.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like
Kika, maybe. That was about it.
That would be appealing. Yeah.
And the thing is, and I don't want to give it away, this movie, it's like you really have to kind of. I will say it engages with that subject more deeply than I think I've seen a film in recent memory. And I don't know that it would work with an actress other than Isabelle Huppert, or with someone who's just so kind of commanding, authoritative, fearless. She plays a woman who is raped in the very opening scene of the movie.
Mm.
So, and it's, and I almost don't want to say anything more than that.
Okay,
go see it. I think a lot of people were expecting it to be much more controversial than it was. Mm. I mean, it is. It may yet get that controversy, but people were like, it got this very warm embrace at the festival. I think, you know, it was not booed, for example. So that's, I'm curious to see how that plays. I think it will get some heated response, but.
Tell us about the experience of going, because neither Dave nor I have ever been. For instance, where do you stay?
Yeah.
How? Because I get the impression that, like, there's the giant.
Where's the food and what are the beds like?
Yeah, I mean, because I know there's these big, gorgeous beach hotels, and that's where that's where Julia Roberts is staying. But, like, for the press and stuff.
Right.
Where do you go?
You're in a cardboard box under a bridge. Yeah.
Well, you know, and it's funny because I, for the first time this year, because, you know, when I was with Variety, of course, they'd sent a huge team and they'd book us these really nice, quite nice apartments.
Oh, cool.
You know, and sometimes I would, I've been roommates with Peter DeBruge several times. Mm. You know, we kind of longtime festival roommates. And these really, you know, this year with the times, because they send a much smaller team, of course, you know, right. I just found an Airbnb, which worked out very well.
Yeah.
Was actually really easy because I think a lot of, this is another thing, I think a lot of people were scared off going to the festival this year by the rumors or word of possible terrorist attack or something.
Right.
Which thankfully did not happen. Security, which was always pretty high to begin with, was very heightened this year. A lot of, you know, just the extra looking in your bag and wanting you the first time, you know. And it's funny, though, as the festival went on and people kind of realized, okay, nothing's going to happen. Hopefully, fingers crossed, knock on wood.
Yeah. It's weird because the year, the closest I ever got to going was the summer I was going to go, like, Uriel Pass through Europe when I was in college, and wound up not going because there was terrorist stuff happening and my friend's parents freaked out. But that was the year of Polanski's Pirates, I remember. That was the big movie. Yeah. Like, they had a big pirate ship in the ocean, and that was, there was panic then about terrorism stuff. I think Stallone didn't go for Cobra because he was worried about terrorists.
I mean, I admit to scanning a lot of the headlines before going and seeing like, they're going to attack by sea, they're going to come in horse. I don't know, ISIS is going to get in the pirate boat, whatever, you know. But it was, thankfully, nothing like that happened, and it was, you know, but you could tell kind of the cooling effect it had a little bit on the festival. The screenings were, it was not as hard to get a seat sometimes.
Huh.
But yeah, no, for the most part, you know, and, you know, it was...
And how far from the action were you at the same
Airbnb? I was about, you know, you always want to be kind of within walking distance, like no more than a 5-minute walk from the Palais, which is the main, you know, giant movie palace where most of the screenings are held.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed a little bit, no, maybe very close still. Huh. And and things were, you know, reasonably affordable and everything. It was, and I don't know if, again, that was just a quirk to this year.
Right.
But usually, you know, it's always been, you know, sometimes, you know, but people come from all over. I mean, people will stay in like Avignon or Juan-les-Pins, you know, nearby towns, and then, you know, get in, and it just, you know, takes a little longer to get in. But, you know, people kind of are lining the streets, of course. And, you know, the people, you know, it's, the other thing is, you know, people waiting for tickets, you know, you don't know where they come from, but, dressed up in their formal wear, and they just hoping, you know, one, the holding signs, one invitation, please, and hoping that someone will take pity on them.
I was going to ask, how many screenings do you have to wear a tuxedo for?
Yeah, you know, I brought my tuxedo this year, and as is sometimes the case, I didn't even get to wear it once, unfortunately, with press screenings, of course, you just I go to most of them, but sometimes you try to make it to a gala. I just didn't this year for whatever reason. Yes, they're very particular. You have to have the bow tie.
Right.
Maybe they've relaxed this. I mean, after the whole scandal over high flat gate last year, perhaps. I think they're pretty still tough on the guys. I think they make you wear, you know, not a necktie, but a bow tie.
Button shirt.
Exactly, yeah. But those are always very, very fun, you know, to go in and, you know, you're in formal wear to watch this, you know, 3-hour Romanian film, which is always, which is a really good film, by the way. Sierra Nevada by Christy Pugh, the guy who did Lazarescu.
Right.
So yeah, it was it's funny because I've been fortunate enough to go many, many years, and you know, this time was a little bit, in some ways it did feel a little bit like going for the first time because I was going with a different outlet and my kind of assignment brief was very different, although it turned out to be a lot of fun. It was kind of great not having to write full reviews of, and the lots of, you know, from the pace we have to work at sometimes, especially festivals, it's just like inhuman, and it was nice to get a little more time to digest and see more movies.
The turnover can be a killer for sure.
Absolutely,
especially for the web, because it's like, it's, you know, now, you know?
Well, Cannes is, I mean, I think festivals in general have become, but Cannes is especially the worst for that kind of competition. I mean, you know,
I felt bad for the people who had to see like Tree of Life and immediately crank out, you know, 500 words about it. Are you kidding?
I mean, it's like, what do you even do? I mean, absolutely. Or just the enormous pressure. You know, I remember when Indiana Jones premiered there or something. You know, it's just like, you know, and they want to know like 5 minutes before the movie's ended or even sooner. So it's just, yeah, it's really nice to not have to deal with that.
Now, with Variety and with the Times, do you get to stray off the main path in terms of not just cover the competition films, but like, oh, I'm going to go check this this director's fortnight or this critics week or even just this random like trade screening or something?
Absolutely. And frankly, I wish I'd done a better job of that this year. I did, you know, this year I was on I was participating in the Screener National Critics Poll, which meant you have to see everything in competition. So that kind of tied my hands, you know, and I was happy to do that, but and it was a great experience, but I do wish I'd gotten more time to spend in the Director's Fortnight or in Critics Week or even in Uncertain Regard, which is the kind of non-competitive side panel to the competition. I will say, you know, there's a really, really terrific movie, Neruda, which was in Director's Fortnight, directed by Pablo Larraine, who, you know, is a great director, who, and kind of, there's always one or two of these films this year, but it's like, why wasn't this in competition? And he had No there a few years ago.
Right.
And so people were pretty surprised that he, you know, it was a better movie than a lot of things that were in competition. It's, you know, it sounds on paper like it's just a Pablo Neruda biopic, and it's actually much more interesting than that. So that's one to check out. I think The Orchard bought that, so that will be coming to a theater at some point. So, yeah.
And then, you know, I always sort of, we talked about, like, when we did a commentary episode about The Apple, and we talked about missing the sort of crazy Golden Globus like hype at Cannes, where they would launch a bunch of titles and movies that are movie stars that never existed, and if nobody bought them, they wouldn't make them. You know, is there still that level of hucksterism of people selling? Like, I saw the Shark Exorcist poster. Yeah. Is there that kind of stuff, like selling these sort of blood and gut bucket movies to Singapore or whatever?
I think so, and I think there's a lot. I mean, and that a lot of that action is in the market, of course, which, you know, drives a lot of the financial side of the festival, but it's, you know, and I remember reading something, I don't have details, but where these projects that come together at the last minute that are clearly have no intention of being made, it's just the weirdest star log line combos you could imagine, and it's just because these companies want to show up saying, oh, we've got something on our slate, but really, you know, just it's more of a pretext than anything else. I can't remember. There was something really, really great and hysterical. It's like, who conceived this, you know? But yeah, there's a lot. Yes, there is a lot of that.
Godard signing a cocktail napkin, agreeing to make King Lear for Canon Films, I think, is one of the great Cannes Film Festival moments of all time. So I want to see that kind of thing go down. Totally. You know? All right. So we have Dave has not gone to see the two crappy big commercial films of the week, but luckily Justin has, so I'm not talking to the wall.
Yeah, for the first time in 5 years of doing this podcast, I have not seen any of the wide release films this week. I will not be going to see...
Oh, well, it's just Memorial Day weekend, you know.
Whatever, dude. I will not be seeing X-Men because I have lost interest.
You've lost that love and feeling?
Yeah, I've lost interest in X-Men. And you came home and didn't like it. And that was kind of all I needed. Now, Amy liked it, which, you know, gives me a little bit of a, well, maybe, you know, because she and I respond to Amy's writing and her opinions a lot. And I find that we see things similarly quite often.
I do not have that with Amy.
And but, so, yeah, like, love like her, but she is more... Like, I'm more in tune with her as a viewer than I am actually with you.
Amy Nicholson.
Yeah, MTV. Amy Nicholson.
Yes. Just kidding. If you did not read her Cannes Diaries, by the way, are pretty good.
They're delightful. Anyway, I will be seeing Alice, even though you did not like it, and virtually no one I know likes it either. But I will be seeing it because our friend...
Oh, true.
Jay Redd was the special effects guy.
Visual effects supervisor.
The visual effects supervisor, and I... want to see his work, and I want to see what he did and, you know, tell him how great he is to his face. Yeah.
Well.
When we get through these two reviews, I'll talk about the movie I did see, which was crazy. And so...
And luckily Justin saw that one too.
And Justin has seen that one too.
All right, well, let's start with Alice through the Looking Glass. Yes. Yeah, our friend Jay Redd was the co-visual effects supervisor with... I always get this guy's name wrong. I think it's Ken Ralston, who was he did the Star Wars effect. Like, he's old school. And, you know, I acknowledge that in my review that, you know, that he's a friend of mine. And I would say his work is certainly up to the minutes.
To the minute. Yeah. Not the problem with the movie.
Absolutely not. No. But it is a reminder that you can't have all, we said on What the Flick, you can't have all gravy. There has to be covering something, and so you've got these amazing effects that are in the service of nothing.
Absolutely nothing. I mean, it's funny too, because I think that, you know, I really hated this movie, but I liked it a skosh better than the first one, as I think you and I, Alonzo, were talking about when we walked out of the screening.
It was less useless.
It was less useless. I also think just not seeing it in 3D, they did not screen it helped that way for us. It really helped. Something as kind of not trivial, but something as small as that can really make a big difference, because I just remember walking out of the first Alice in Wonderland thinking that was just one of the ugliest things I'd visually just and creatively, you know, I'd seen that in a very long time.
That immediate post Avatar moment where they would just turn things into 3D, whether they were supposed to be or not. And I remember actually about a year or two later, I was researching an article about 3D televisions for like at Christmas time. And I went to the Sony store at some mall and they had all these display models of, and one of the TVs they had clearly like sort of a 20-minute kind of highlight reel, like here's what this looks like and here's what that looks like. And one of the things on it was a clip from that Alice in Wonderland. And on that monitor, it looked great.
It looked great, yeah.
And I was with our friend Dave Cobb, who you know works on theme parks and knows a lot about how this stuff works. He goes, yeah, well, they edited it on a monitor like this one. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to translate to when they project it big. 3D, so.
Right.
Although I will say, Jay on Facebook and promoting the film said, go see it in 3D IMAX. So I don't know. But you're right. Seeing it in 2D made it less annoying.
It might have even been a matter of that theater. Maybe projected otherwise, you know, under the right.
Yeah,
ideal conditions. It looks, you know, but again, yeah, I mean, I approach this, you know, sometimes I'm trying to wean myself of this, the whole kind of compare the movie against the book. It's like that is, you know, that can be limiting. That's not the only way to look at a movie. But I was kind of, you know, I read Lewis Carroll's books, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, obsessively as a kid. I picked them apart because they are meant to be picked apart. There's so much great stuff there. It's those books are kind of an intellectual feast.
There are great annotated editions that sort of explain all the things that are going on.
It's like one of my favorite things, and just still picking up and leaving through it sometimes. And so to me, I can't completely put that aside when I see these movies, which are just so vacant to me.
Yeah, you know, well, it's like
there's nothing of it. They've taken just the most. I mean, they do look great.
Mm.
I think. Too many, even I think good films of Alice in Wonderland have too often privileged, oh, Lewis Carroll's movies are very, his world is very visual. It's very, you know, but I think they often kind of prioritize that over what's more interesting about his work.
The words, sure.
The language and
It's sort of like, okay, this is an action movie, but it's about Heathcliff and Catherine, you know, it's like, and we're going to take these characters and just sort of plop them into this thing that doesn't really have anything to do with why they ever existed in the first place.
Time travel movie, and I really felt this too, even though Tim Burton did not direct this movie, and, you know, and hey, I like my share of Tim Burton movies, but I felt like it picked up some of the worst aspects of his films, which is the daddy issues. Sister issues. There's all this just really just, you know, this kind of family trauma, backstory, tortured angst thing.
My inner
child. Which is just like, it just kind of nauseated me applying that to these,
And the stakes are so minimal. It's like, I have to threaten to unmake the fabric of time because the Mad Hatter is sad.
I know. I have to say, we did not know about the Johnny Depp scandal when we watched the movie, and I certainly not when we were writing our reviews, but there's something about his presence in this movie and just his performance and his affect, I guess, that just really repulsed me. I don't know. I don't like the look of the makeup. I don't like the look of the character. I don't like the acting he's doing. And I'm not drawing a connection. I'm just saying it kind of disturbed and repulsed me.
I found myself getting lost in the line, the eyelashes, the markings around his eyes. It was sort of hypnotic, and I just wasn't even listening to what he was saying after a while.
I guess that could be a good thing.
Maybe, you know. I don't know. Alec Mappa has a line that I always quote, which is like, when we go to see these movies, we're basically paying to watch Johnny Depp trick or treat. You know, and at least with Black Mass, he was giving a performance while also indulging his like latex
that
fetish, basically. But I'm really bored with these. I was saying that, like, you know, like Peter Sellers often got too lost and I'm gonna play four characters and one's gonna be Chinese, you know. I like, you know, that eventually then he makes his being there, you know. I'm waiting for Johnny Depp's being there now.
I look forward to that.
But yeah, this was tedious. And then X-Men Apocalypse.
Which I would tell Dave, I would say go see it, because I did like it a lot.
You did?
I did.
Really?
But yeah. But I am, and it's funny because,
explain.
I'm going to sit back and listen to this.
It's kind of funny, too, because I know that one of our favorite things to do as critics is to bemoan just that there's just too damn many comic book superhero movies.
Sure.
And I say that, and I've always kind of upheld that, even, and as someone who did not grow up reading comic books, doesn't read them now, doesn't read graphic novels, whatever. But but X-Men is kind of the one, it's the cartoon I actually did used to watch. And so I admit to a certain amount of, I'm not an expert on, I had to, Wikipedia a few things before and after seeing it. But this is one that I've had a little more investment in. I do think that Bryan Singer has a kind of flair for this material that I think just kind of comes second nature to him. And I don't think this is the best one in the series that he's done, but I really felt this was the one kind of, I have to say too, I thought Deadpool was hilarious. Mm-hmm. I think Captain America is quite, the Civil War was quite good. But this one, I sort of just, it was kind of like a reuniting with an old friend kind of a moment with this movie.
Up until this one, I'm with you on the Bryan Singer thing. I really think that he got something. He understood something about X-Men. I still think X2 was
terrific.
Among the apex of this whole genre. This one to me felt cluttered. I was bored. And also, I felt like the thing that makes the Singer movie so good is that they're about something else. They're metaphors about the civil rights movement, or about, coming out as gay, or about any sort of
otherness of any form.
Otherness, exactly. Yes, yeah. Exactly. And this movie seemed to not care about that at all.
It's interesting. I wonder about that. I mean, for me, it was there, but it's also because if you've watched these movies, if you kept up with them, it's like, I know what you mean. Maybe they feel they don't need to hammer it anymore, and maybe that's a sign of progress, I don't know.
If you'd given me something else to chew on, sure, I wouldn't miss it. But this felt to me like empty spectacle. And then if you start thinking about anything for too long, it's like, wait, this is 10 years after X-Men First or Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
So you start asking questions about the timeline, and your mind just goes down a rabbit hole.
I didn't even bother with it because I really liked Days of Future Past.
I didn't do that until later, but it was just another thing who's minding the store here?
But in a way, it's weird. And I know I don't disagree with you, and yet it's weird. In a weird way, this is the one series where you can kind of, for me anyways, slip on and slip off, kind of like an old shoe. But I know what you mean, because if you try to tie it together linearly or pay attention to the chronology, I'm sure, and especially since Days of Future Past was going back and forth in time.
Right, and they revamped the timeline and all that I was forgiving of, but just other things. When somebody pointed out, why does Quicksilver look exactly the same when it's been 10 years have passed,
That's so great.
But that scene is exactly in Days of Future Past. It's like, oh, come
I didn't
on.
Mind.
You, no, I did.
Was,
I, did
because, I wanted, I, that scene was exactly what I needed.
See, because at that point, I was so bored, and the big Quicksilver sort of glory moment happens. I'm like, you did this already. I loved this scene in Days of Future Past, and you're just doing it again, but bigger.
Well, I will say this too, Alonzo, in the negative column for me, I do think I was pretty appalled by the Auschwitz scene, which. Yeah. I'll just leave it at that. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
There's a scene at Auschwitz. And it's
and they have dragged Auschwitz in before with Magneto, and it's worked. And
it's worked, and I've always generally admired Singer for, ever since the very first X-Men thing.
It's been one of those metaphorical things that works.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a risky thing to do. I don't think the risk paid off this time. No. But otherwise, I did like the film.
And I thought... Okay, there's that joke in the first X-Men movie where they talk about yellow spandex, and it's sort of like it's a wink to the audience, like, okay, we know this is what they look like in the comics, but this is a movie, and that would look ridiculous. I thought about that joke when Olivia Munn comes trotting out in that ridiculous Psylocke costume, where it's like, only straight comic artists would come up with boob windows.
You didn't tell me this movie had boob windows.
It has boob windows, yes.
Well, I'm going now.
Well, if you'd read my review, you would have seen the term ninja stripper. So,
I listened to you read your review to me, didn't I?
I think you did, yes.
Acknowledge that?
Who knows? Who knows what you do?
The new Storm, though. Improvement on Halle Berry, I think.
I didn't mind Halle Berry. A friend of mine
she was on Wendy Williams this week.
A friend of mine who is a big Storm fan was not happy.
Not happy with the way they treated her character.
How they retconned her. And I just did you read that piece that I think Sam Adams wrote for Playlist?
I did actually. Yeah, it was a good piece.
How like these end of the world scenarios are boring because we know how they're not going to go all the way.
You know, and I've been a real. I completely agree with that. Thesis in general. What I find interesting, and maybe getting away from X-Men, is I think it's interesting, even like a really quite bad movie like Batman v Superman, and a good one like Captain America, what I think is interesting about these two in particular is that I think they're starting to, we're maybe entering sort of the self-critique stage of these comic, maybe, you know, of these comic movies where they're sort of acknowledging the collateral damage and making it intrinsic to the plot, you know, where like, you know, somebody dies and so there's that actually, you know, hey, that matters, you know, I mean, they're, and I don't know that they're completely doing that really persuasively, but I'm a little refreshed at least that they're doing it at all, I mean, making some acknowledgement.
Like Ant-Man, you know? I didn't like, but at least they sort of made the stakes smaller. As far as acknowledging the collateral damage, that's a weird sort of eat your cake and have it too thing. And Dave has very eloquently talked about how all the superhero movies all of the superhero movies are basically a response to 9/11.
Don't nobody forget that. Eloquently.
Absolutely.
That these movies are all about 9/11. And as much as I like the idea that that Batman versus Superman tried to cop to the fact that Man of Steel was so blasé about that fact. It didn't. That didn't help BVS anymore. Like
it didn't make it a better movie. No, I mean, it was a little more interesting. And again, what I think I liked about Days of Future Past, looking back, was that it was one of those movies that did not actually have gobs of destruction in it. I mean, unlike Apocalypse, you know. I think
the beginning,
but overall, it didn't climax. And you know, actually, that's what I'm refreshing about Civil War too is that. You know, there's that big
the
fight
stakes
scene,
are personal.
But the stakes are personal. It's self-contained,
and the big fight scene's in the middle.
It's
in a big
airport hangar that doesn't
no one's around. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So more empty airports and toy train tracks. You know, and then I have one other one, but I'll get to it later. You guys can talk about
what's the one. What's the one other one?
The ones below. But fine. I'll just polish it off. Okay.
60 seconds.
All
go.
Right, fine. It's a British thriller with David Morrissey and Clémence Poésy. And you have a young couple living upstairs in a sort of duplex British flat. And the guy downstairs died or was murdered or whatever. And this new couple moves in. And it turns out that both the upstairs wife and the downstairs wife are pregnant. What are the odds? And the downstairs wife starts kind of making friends with Clémence Poésy, a little awkwardly and a little too friendly, but you know, whatever, it's fine. And then they have a dinner party and a terrible thing happens, and I don't want to give away anything beyond that, but it gets tense and it plays on the whole. It's not Rosemary's Baby in an occult way, but it is in the terms of pregnant woman paranoid thriller, you know, anxiety. and can I trust my senses, and are the things that are happening around me really happening, or am I just losing it? And Ben and Christy loved this movie, and I was like, I thought it was okay, and I don't know if maybe I would have liked it more if I'd seen it on a screen as opposed to a screener, or maybe I would have liked it more if I had a child. I felt like it was there are certain movies where I think I wish we weren't stuck in the. I mean, it's like 86 minutes long, but even then, I wish we weren't kind of always stuck in the sort of feature film. Format, because I think this would have been a solid 45-minute, you know, Tales from the Dark Side episode, and as a movie it felt a little like, okay, I can see where this is going, let's go there now, you know. But it's worth seeing. People are liking it more than I did, you know, it's well acted and very tightly focused in terms of the storytelling. I mean, it could have been sharper in terms of being shorter, but I like the way it was shot. I think there's a lot of thought that's put into the interior design and that kind of thing. And I liked the acting. And so, you know, it's if nothing else, like when it pops up on cable in 6 months, you know, give it a look.
The wailing. What did you call it earlier?
The yowling.
The yowling.
The yowling.
The yowling.
The ululating.
Okay, so South Korean filmmaker Na Hong Jin. This is his new film. He made The Chaser. He made
the Yellow Sea. You saw this at Cannes last year.
This past, it was just there, just this past Cannes.
Oh, it was just, past, yeah. It was just
so opening very quickly. After,
oh, okay,
yeah,
okay.
So
I thought it's been around. All right.
Yes.
It opens with a title card, a passage from the book of Luke. Here's the passage. But they were startled and frightened and thought they saw a spirit. And he said to them, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." And the next thing you see is a fisherman putting a worm on a hook.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, so you're Jesus. And then this Japanese fisherman, who is a stranger in the small town where the film takes place, keeps coming back every time yet another person is brutally slaughtered. And I mean brutally slaughtered. This is an occult is serial killer the right word?
Serial killer, zombie, demonic possession.
Yes.
Wow.
And the people,
everything.
I think we have a bingo.
The people of the town are like, well, ever since that Japanese guy came to town, folks keep dying in crazy ways. And they don't just keep dying. They keep being killed by new people who have lost their minds.
Hmm.
And they're possessed by something.
What's the Denzel Washington movie where the demon hops from body to body?
Oh.
Do you remember that one?
Yes. It's escaping me.
Like Fallen?
It is Fallen.
Is it Fallen?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So the central character is a police detective, a sergeant. And he's a little hapless. Like
it's almost a surprise that he isn't played by Song Kang-ho.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, he's very good, the actor who plays him, whose name I don't recall, but...
But he's
kind of bumbling.
He's bumbling. Yeah. He's constantly freaked out by
Inspector Clouseau.
Every time he comes upon a new crime scene, he's like, "Oh my god!" He's like running away,
or like people like vomiting or something. Yeah,
someone vomits on him, or you know.
Yeah,
and so there's this strange strain of humor that runs through this grisly film. And it's an everyday sort of humor that peppers the movie. And it's of the variety of people looking at each other and saying something like, "Can you believe this is happening?" They're scared. They get scared. People get, like, you know, in a lot of crime films, the detectives are like, they're so hard-boiled that nothing fazes them.
Right.
And every time the police come across something new, they're like, "Ugh." Yes. He has bad dreams where a demon is chasing him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which
are very scary.
Which are very frightening.
Yeah, very.
And so there are so many things going on in this film. It's 2.5 hours long. But never once is it boring. It is fully absorbing, fully engrossing, just this maximum everything at once kind of film. The police detective's little daughter starts exhibiting signs of this possible
possession.
Meanwhile, that Japanese fisher dude, he keeps hanging around, and clearly, you know, like clearly he's like a demon or a spirit, or he is a Christ figure, but in that Flannery O'Connor way where the Christ figure might annihilate you, you know.
He just kind of stares.
He stares.
He just stares at you. Yeah.
The Koreans and the Japanese, you know how we people get along so well.
And that tension is definitely...
Oh, that's fully there.
Totally
because
part of the movie, yeah.
It's, when they refer to him, it's as a slur.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And...
Which you can guess.
So the townspeople all suspect the Japanese man and or a mushroom tonic that's quite popular...
Matango.
Later on, there's another person who comes along, a mystery woman whose alliances you are not fully sure of.
the little daughter gets more and more possessed. They do what everyone does. They call a shaman who comes in and does a lot of Exorcist 2 stuff to her.
Ooh.
Like, there's people spitting blood on machetes and waving them around the little girl's head. The violence and exuberant occult stuff in this movie is really extravagant. Biting, impaling, metal rakes to the head, goat sacrifices, death hexes and chicken sacrifices and voodoo dolls, people gnawing on each other's heads. It's crazy. I think I'm in love with this film.
I gotta see it now. You talk me into it.
And it continues to have all of these Jesus references.
Yeah.
The idea of there's something close to the end I won't talk about, but there's a lot of references to, well, before this rooster crows three times.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Huh. You know, which is what, you know, in the Bible, it's the rooster crowed once, but Judas had betrayed Christ three times.
No. Also, the he tells Paul, you will betray me three times.
Yes.
Or three times before the rooster crows once. Or whatever.
There are a lot of, there's at least one reference to having 3 days to escape something. So a lot of things that come from the Bible that are never actually fully explained or included in who's doing what to whom. Yeah. I am always thrilled to see a filmmaker approach material that's been done a million times, occult, serial killing, you know, murder,
right,
thrillers. But I'm really excited to see a filmmaker approach it in a fresh, idiosyncratic way that keeps you guessing and keeps you wondering, and even when it's over, you're still not quite sure everything about everything that happened. And so, I dig this. It's maximum overdrive. I'm really into it.
This movie leaves you feeling that it's possibly evil.
Yeah.
Really, you know?
Yeah.
And it's
because
funny,
its rhythm is very much like you're being drawn into this demonic sort of ritual itself. Yeah.
I'm going to kind of suspend judgment because I am going to see this movie again, because I have to write about it, and it's kind of you brought that back so vividly. It's like, just not only just what's in the movie, but just the weird rhythm of the movie too.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so all over the place in a way that I found really interesting, also frustrating at times. And I'm a huge fan of Na Hong Jin as well.
Yeah.
I think I love The Chaser. Mm-hmm. I loved The Yellow Sea, both of which I also saw at Cannes.
Yeah.
And I just walked out thinking that was just the most jacked up thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's just like, and this one is too. It's way more ambitious. I mean, what he's doing here, it is much longer. Part of me, am I mad for wanting to go see it again? But,
it again.
There's something about it.
Just
know?
Because I felt so overwhelmed by it. That
it's an overwhelming experience.
When I feel that way after a film is over, I think I should see this another time.
And who's releasing this? Wellgo USA? Or?
Good question.
I don't remember.
Oh, well.
We know
it is currently playing in Los Angeles at
the CGV cinemas.
I was going to say GNC, but that's the vitamin people.
CGV.
CGV. It's a Korean film chain that they've opened their first theater here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it's there. I know it goes somewhere else in a week or so.
This Friday, June 3rd, it will open wider.
Yes.
Okay, so be on the lookout. And what's it called again? It's like you're saying the wrong thing.
The canoodling.
No.
It's called the wailing.
The wailing.
The wailing.
Gotcha. Okay.
The wailing.
Because I kept thinking it was, is it the howling? No, that, or did somebody use that? Okay, the wailing. Cool. All right, well, yeah, I'm totally going to go see this thing. Yes. It sounds bananas. Justin, what's your DVD pick?
Oh. Oh, my gosh.
You got one?
We can come back to you if you
want. Come back to me.
Okay. Dave? Oh, all right, fine. I'm going to say X2, just because watching X-Men Apocalypse was such a disappointment for me, partially because X2 was so great. And I felt that even Days of Future Past, while it's not my favorite of the X-Men movies, it was a reminder of, Bryan Singer is the guy. He has a handle on this material, because You know, between X2 and Days of Future Past, there were two Wolverine movies that he didn't make and two X-Men movies that he didn't make. And First Class is okay. It's definitely way better than the awful Brett Ratner movie. But
we should note too, there is a pretty funny dig at that movie in X-Men Apocalypse, which made me laugh.
It was funny, but by the end of it, I was like, you know what?
This movie's not that much better.
You
didn't earn
in
that.
In the glass house of Apocalypse, you don't get to throw that stone. But anyway, yeah, but X2, I still think, you know, I put it right up there with like The Dark Knight and The Incredibles and the first Avengers movie as being like just, you know, Winter Soldier, like the very best of this kind of movie.
Yeah.
And I think it still totally holds up. And if you go to the wrap, I did a ranking of all 9 X-Men movies, which includes Deadpool, because it's the X-Men universe. It counts.
In the family.
Na Hong Jin's The Chaser is a serial killer film as well. And they're hunting for a serial killer that they can't quite pin it on, in the world of sex workers. And genre films like this and like The Wailing, they don't have to be, like the perfect word you used, they don't have to be ambitious, but his are. Now, I have not seen The Yellow Sea yet. But both are easily available. Like, you can get them on DVD. You can see The Yellow Sea on Amazon streaming. I just looked that up the other day because I was like, I need to catch up on Yellow Sea. But yeah, check out this dude because he's something.
He really is.
Cool.
I'm tempted to make The Yellow Sea my pick, but I'm actually going to go with Only Lovers Left Alive, the previous Jim Jarmusch film, which, you know, and it's funny, Jim Jarmusch is a director who I've always, you know, admired, you know, never, you know, hasn't been someone I've loved every single one of his films, but I really think he's, you know, and I'm very curious for people to see Patterson, but I think he's kind of on a roll these days.
Jim Jarmusch helped define the 1980s for me when I was young. Stranger Than Paradise, I saw it, I thought, oh, movies can be really, really weird like this. Yes. And I was so happy about that. And David Lynch.
He's always been in the category of people I admire more than you love, perhaps. But I really do love Only Lovers Left Alive, and I'm very excited to see Patterson.
I think it's interesting because he's making these movies that are sort of, you know, in a more kind of later, autumnal, kind of more relaxed stage, but they're every bit as distinctive. Patterson is, I think, a crowd pleaser by his standards. I mean, it is the most accessible. You know, Adam Driver, it's really good, but I really am a fan of kind of what he's been doing, and I think just Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton and Only Lovers Left Alive is vampires who've been married for centuries. It's just I just love that movie so much.
He can kind of do anything. You know how you have those favorite bands where even if their record is weird and off-putting, you're still like, yay, they did something. Like, that's how I feel about Jim Jarmusch, and I'm the freak that loved The Limits of Control, you know, so so
Jarmusch, like Dolan, is one where I need to get more caught up. Like, I've never seen Ghost Dog, and I've never seen Dead Man.
Ghost Dog is dope, and you need to... That's your first thing. We're going to do a... Make Me, you're going to get maked.
Fine. we've been saying for years we're going to do a segment called Make Me. we're going to trade months, and we make the other one watch a movie that they've been saying for years. Oh, I'm going to get around to this, and they never do.
The premise here being that we've spent almost 21 years together as a couple, and over these 21 years, saying to each other, wait a second, I've never shown you blah, blah, blah. How have I failed this marriage? And... So now we're going to work it into this podcast.
Something came up recently that you had not seen that I was shocked by. And I can't
probably remember
something
dumb and gay that you were into.
No. It's a legitimately good movie. And I was like, it was in somebody's letter last week that you copped it not having seen. I was like, are you, what? So I'll dig that up and figure it out. But anyway, that's coming later. Did you want to, do we have time for a letter this week? Or
why not?
All right.
How long have we been on for?
A little over an hour.
Okay. We'll get a letter.
Okay.
All right.
We have a big backlog, we know, and we
have a really big backlog.
I suspect we have another all-letter episode in our future.
I don't know. This fan mail?
Well,
hate mail?
Mix of both. Usually fan mail.
Mostly.
And, of course, you know, Dave started asking people who don't usually write the show to write the show, and they did, and then since he did that, we haven't had time to read them, so, you know.
This is from Ken.
Yay, us. Yes, okay, Ken.
Dear David Alonso, I may be one of your younger listeners. I am a junior in high school.
Whoa, okay.
And on that note, forgive me if this rambles. I am exhausted. Because I just came home from the prom, in which, among other things, my abilities as a stunningly mediocre slow dancer were confirmed. Here's the thing about slow dancing.
No one's good at it.
Nobody does it properly. I mean, okay, here's how it is. If you're doing it properly, you're going to end the night
pregnant.
Real lucky. Yeah. Therefore, very few people do it properly. Right. But I thought I would share this email before I fell asleep at my laptop. Side note, I basically did, and that's why I'm sending this to you 7 hours after I started writing it. Anyway, I've been a fan of this podcast ever since hearing about it through What the Flick.
Yay!
And it's quickly become one of my favorites for movie discussion. My own online film criticism output is mostly limited to a review blog I run, which is linked in my signature if you're so inclined to check it out. His review blog is filmreviews12.com.
Okay.
Anybody listening wants to go there and check out young Ken's film reviews.
Have at it.
You should do that. I thought I would share my top 10 list or something like it, aside from the top 3 or 4 titles. I have a feeling the composition of this list changes every time I'm asked about it. Well, guess what?
That's how lists work.
When you're my age, which is 1,000 years old, it will continue to change like that. Let us knife this child.
Okay.
Sorry to call you a child, but you are a minor. 10, Le Samurai.
Ooh. Good
choice. Yeah, somebody's fancy already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Woo approves of this choice.
Toy Story.
Okay.
Carol.
Yeah.
It's Such a Beautiful Day.
Oh, yeah. That's the Don Hertzfeld.
Yeah. Spirited Away.
Oh, very totally.
Nice. Psycho.
Yeah.
Totally.
Helicopter Noise.
I'm assuming the Hitchcock Psycho and not the Van Sant.
Yo, know, the Gus Van Sant. Yeah.
Perverse.
The 400 Blows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Come and See.
Mm.
I don't know that one.
1985.
What's Come and See?
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's one I've been... I can't believe I haven't seen it either, but it's considered one of these
well,
seminal
Ken,
great...
You stumped Justin Chang.
You, well, Ken, you just outsaw three film critics. So
well done.
But you get, it's a gimme.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of your knifing...
That gets an
automatic thumb up for that one, even if it sucks. But it probably doesn't suck.
Probably not.
I've heard it doesn't suck.
Back to the Future.
Okay.
Back to the Future is great.
It's fine. I'm a generational anomaly. I was never crazy about Back to the Future.
12 Angry Men.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was number one?
Yes.
All right. Well, you are 100% knife, sir.
You are 100% knife. Congratulations, Ken. Here's another one. We'll do one more.
Okay. La da dee, la da da, la da dee, la da. But she is homeless. She's homeless.
Dear Dave White. Well, this is just for me, so you guys
okay,
go in the other room.
Fine.
the subject line is risen.
Oh.
So he's referencing something from a few. Yes. Months back. Dear Dave White, I am Rodolfo from Brazil. I listen to your podcast, Always I Can. I've watched Risen recently and later heard your thoughts about the movie. I was raised as Christian, and although I don't... Okay, there's English. Okay, I am not very religious nowadays. I still have sympathy for religion. To me, the movie is kind of a version of the Hobbit trilogy, where the reluctant hero has to do a quest, helping some weird creatures, the apostles in this case, and is assisted by the occasional magic from Jesus. Don't you agree? Yes! I agree.
Is the Jesus also the treasure in this one?
Best wishes and congratulations for your podcast. Thank you, Rodolfo.
Thank you.
You want to do one more?
Yeah, why not?
Before we're done? Okay, here we go. This is from Willem.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, guys. I'm a longtime listener to the podcast. It was Dave's impressive voice work that lured me in. Thank you again.
Thrillionaires. I'm a
cartoon dog for hire. But Alonzo's knowledge of the cinema and your lovely discussions kept me hooked. Also, thanks for your recommendations to other podcasts like the B-Movies podcast.
You're welcome.
B-Movies podcast, sorry. Yeah. He has a list for knifing as well.
Okay.
Network.
Great.
Catch 22. These are all 70s films.
Okay.
Catch 22.
Awesome and underrated.
Sleuth.
Oh. Ooh, fun.
Yeah. Charlie Varick. I've never seen Charlie Varick.
And yeah. I, it's funny. This week I had a conversation with our friend Dave Kittredge about various 70s movies, and I was saying that I've need to see Charlie Varick and The Friends of Eddie Coyle. Those are like two sort of raved about kind of action-y movies I've never seen.
El Topo.
Okay.
Duck You Sucker.
Oh, fun. Yeah, that's Sergio Leone.
The Warriors.
Yeah.
Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Of course.
Which I love. The Castle of Cagliostro.
Yes.
Cagliostro.
That's Miyazaki's first feature.
You're 100% knife.
Absolutely.
Willem. He gave some honorable mentions, too. Here they are.
Sure.
Jean Dielman.
Okay.
Kansas City Bomber.
Yeah.
Prime Cut. Zabriskie Point.
Yeah.
Traffic.
Uh-huh.
Trouble Man.
Okay.
Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter.
Whoa, all right.
Willem is from the Netherlands. P.S. I don't know exactly how the international versions of iTunes works, but apparently they are invisible to you guys.
Yes.
So here is a screenshot of the Dutch version where I posted my review.
Oh, thank you, Willem.
And he reviewed us and said that we are a lovely couple. We're very informative. We have fun conversations about new releases. Classics, Christmas movies, religious movies, festival visits, stories about the business, cooking, Los Angeles. Check out their spinoff, LKTV, as well. That is a thing you should do.
Yes.
I'm going to bring it back around.
I saw you doing it.
Join our club.
Yes.
Go to Patreon, patreon.com
//
Linoleum Knife. It will tell you everything you need to know. Subscription levels begin at $4 and end at $20.
Mm-hmm.
And the more money you give us, the more things you get.
Right.
If it were me, like I always say, just do the $4 one. Because that $4 gets you LKTV,
mm-hmm.
which is like a couple more hours a week of us talking. And it's $1 a week.
Yeah.
That's $1 a week. And I'm a cheap person. And my favorite podcast in the world would not convince me to part with anything more than $4 a week. I'm grateful for y'all who are at that $20 level or all the other levels, but if it were me,
well, thankfully,
I'm always pushing the $4 a month.
Thankfully, other people are, you know, a little more profligate in their love. And they want stuff.
No, I'm grateful.
Yes.
I'm grateful for every one of the 215 people who have subscribed since we started this a little while back. But if it were me, I'd be the $4 a month guy.
By the way, and thank you, Willem, for the review on iTunes. If you are in a country that is not the United States and you've left us an iTunes review that we've never seen, feel free to take a screenshot and send it to us so that we can propererly thank you for it. Because, we don't see that stuff. So how would we know?
I begin thanking people.
Well, of course. Well, first of all, Justin, thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you for having me.
You're a delight.
This was delightful. You guys are delightful.
Where can people find you online?
Oh, LATimes.com.
Okay.
It's actually just Google, I guess, Justin Chang, LA Times. That's what I've been doing before I learned how to bookmark.
You tweet, do you not?
I do tweet at Justin C. Chang.
That's, perfect.
Yes. Two C's.
Two
C's. Justin C.
Justin Chang. C and then Chang.
My middle name.
Okay. Yes.
Excellent. Cool. Well, as always, we thank you guys for listening, and we thank all of our Patreon supporters.
Do you Instagram?
I do. Same handle.
Justin C. Chang.
Yes.
Okay. Well, there you go. You know, as always, check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Go to the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Gray and Matt. The B-Movies podcast and Canceled Too Soon, the new show from Bibbs and Whitney. And I'm going to be on soon, so that'll
this
be fun.
Coming Friday.
Well,
recording.
We're taping it, and then I don't know whenever
when
they
are
post
they posting it.
They do. They're an every other week show. So
they are.
Yeah,
oh,
they'll have a day. They need more time because they got a lot of stuff to watch for that.
They have
show.
To watch a whole season sometimes.
Exactly
of a show,
of a TV show. Yes, show. There's a. This is not just a fly by night operation
like LKTV,
for instance. Check out The Schmoes Know, The Sewers of Paris, The Joe Ryan Thing, the Brett Easton Ellis Podcast, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and do please leave us a review. It helps people find the show. We are on Twitter and Instagram, at LinoleumCast. You can stream the show at The Lounge and Stitcher Radio, and now on Google Play or Google Music, and I don't really know how that works, but we're there, so if that means something to you, go do it. That's so exciting. And of course, you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, top 10 lists. And if you are not a Patreon member and you want to buy any of our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes on their own.
Hey, guess what?
What?
There are still, and not counting the people who've subscribed.
Yes.
There are still a grand total of two people.
No, three.
Oh, three. There is still now, there's a grand total of three people, thanks, new person, who have bought the latest Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode, where we talk about the Darden Brothers, 2 days, one night.
Yes.
And that cracks me up. exactly three people have purchased that. It doesn't offend me. I think someone thought I was offended last time.
Yeah. No, just we
hey, did you see the new Darden in
at Ken? I did.
And how do you feel?
It's a little disappointing, which I've rarely ever said.
Really?
Them, and I adore the
just on their standards or in general?
I'll follow
by
them
their standards,
anywhere.
By any no.
Yeah.
Would I recommend this movie? Absolutely. Is it a good movie? Yeah, I think so. But I think it's you know, but it's weird. I think they are always enemies of they're like their own worst enemy sometimes because every movie they've made is of a certain quality and consistency, you know. And but I loved 2 Days, One Night, actually. This one is a bit of a falling off, but an interesting one.
Okay.
It got some really nasty. I mean, it wasn't booed at Ken, but people were like hating on it. It's like, how can you hate on a Darden
these guys? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it was a little extreme.
Cheap. So anyway, live at booed at Ken.
Yeah. If you watch 2 Days, One Night, it's streaming on Netflix.
Yes.
Then give us $1.99.
Yes. PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. You can purchase that extra episode or any of the other 11 ones, including such relative favorites.
You've got these memorized now. Do you?
I'm not going to do it. No, I don't. I every time I try, I always forget one. But okay, fine. You're gonna
let's try it.
Okay, let's work backwards. I think that makes the most sense. Okay, Die Hard.
Yeah.
The Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yes.
Snoopy Come Home.
Yes.
Oh God, I know we're just going to go out of order now. All right, Clue.
Yes.
Josie and the Pussycats. Two for the Road. The Apple. White Christmas. Santa Claus. And one other one.
The other one!
The other one! Whatever it is.
Thank Blue.
Thank you,
Don't
Blue.
Don't forget to thank Blue.
No, your heavens, no. Thank you, Blue, for our great theme music. Find out more about his exciting stuff at Bluetopia, BLEUTOPIA.com. And we will be back next week. Go read Justin Chang's stuff. He's great.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.